mother, not far away, but powerless to intervene as her son is ripped and torn and killed. She was undoubtedly moved, but the Roman soldiers were not moved. Historians tell us that these Roman soldiers were well trained and well practiced in these executions that they carried out. The scourging was designed to inflict terrible punishment upon the backs and on the sides. Roman torturers used a device which they called the flagellum, which was a whip with lead balls and sheep bones tied into the leather thongs at regular intervals. And the victim, stripped naked and tied to a post, would then be whipped with that flagellum, leaving lacerations that would go down all the way to the bone. Flogging always caused extreme pain and extreme blood loss. But the soldiers had seen it all before. This was nothing new to them. They had done this many times. The cries of their victims didn't bother them anymore. It was a job. And the tears of the onlookers didn't invoke feelings of pity. If anything, it probably only goaded them on. It was, in fact, so routine to flog and to crucify a man such as Jesus that they could, on this occasion, pause for a moment in order to entertain themselves a little bit, to do something different this time, to have a little fun by dressing him in a purple robe and giving him a crown fashioned from thorns and mocking him, putting a reed in his hand as if it were a royal scepter, and then taking it away and beating him on the head on that crown of thorns and spitting upon him and taunting him. Eventually, when they took him and hung him upon the cross, they whiled away their boredom by playing some games of chance as they gambled for his clothing. But then something different happens this time, something which they were not expecting. And as we read the end of the crucifixion scene in Mark chapter 15, starting in verse 37, it says that Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom when the centurion, who was standing right in front of him, saw the way he breathed his last. He said, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." One soldier, actually the leader of the group. The word centurion literally means leader of 100. See the root cent in there, like 1 cent out of a dollar? A centurion is a leader of 100 people. This leader of soldiers realized that something different had occurred on this occasion. Something different from all of those other executions. And Mark credits his sudden statement of faith to the way Jesus breathed his last. But I would submit to you that there's a lot more going on here. In fact, I think that it's fair to suggest that there are at least three other things contributing to the centurion's sudden change of attitude. I mean, rarely has someone's estimation of a man's character changed so drastically in the matter of just a couple of hours as this centurion going from, this is a convicted felon, a man worthy of death, all the way to, this man was the Son of God. Still not perfect in his confession of faith, for if he really understood Jesus, he would say, this is the Son of God. But at least to understand that Jesus is who he claimed to be, a tremendous statement of faith. What brought it about? Well, the first thing is that it's very likely that he had already heard, if not Christ personally, but at least heard of Christ's teachings. Soldiers actually show up a lot in the Gospels. When John the Baptist was doing his preaching in Luke chapter 3, it's not just the Jews who went out to hear John speak of the coming kingdom, but Roman soldiers in droves came out to John as well. And they even asked him, "What should we do?" And he told them. There are some officers in John chapter 7 who were sent out by the authorities to seize Jesus and bring him in for trial. And they got there and they surrounded Jesus and they paused there for a moment to listen to his teaching. And before you know it, they had gotten caught up in everything that he was saying so that they eventually just sort of wandered back to their leader. And when they showed up, but where's the man you were sent to arrest? And they said, never has a man so spoken. And that must be some speech to cause Roman soldiers to forget or defy orders and to think that that excuse is going to hold water. But this guy, you needed to hear him. He was amazing. And yet when they heard Jesus, they knew something different was there. So maybe the commander was with that group, or maybe he had heard a report of that group. The word of Jesus' teachings had circulated around Jerusalem. Maybe he picked up on some of that already. But whether or not that is the case, certainly the centurion watched this man Jesus act very different, even in such a stressful, unjust, painful situation. I would just have to imagine that most unjustly accused criminals in this situation protested loudly, proclaiming over and over again their innocence, howling with rage and in pain each and every time they experienced the injustice of the pain of the lash and the mocking and the beating and the nails and the cross, but not Jesus. Jesus was silent as a lamb. I imagine that most unjustly crucified men, when mockery was hurled at them, that they would hurl it right back. Jesus did not verbally retaliate against those who mocked him, not even while he was on the cross. In fact, Jesus did the opposite in Luke 23 and verse 34. Jesus said, "Father, forgive them," saying out loud to both the crowds and the soldiers and anyone who could hear, "Father, they don't know what they're doing. Forgive them." I highly doubt the centurion, in all the hundreds of executions he had presided over, had ever heard a man ask God for forgiveness for his persecutors. I highly doubt. The criminal next to Jesus initially abused him. The other one continued to do so. But in the case of the one, Jesus reasoned with him. Imagine that, being at the last extent of your life and having time to engage someone in a religious discussion. For Jesus to take the opportunity to turn this man's mind away from mockery and toward the truth, so that on the cross, by the end of this, that criminal said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." I doubt the centurion had ever heard a conversation like that on a cross. And he heard other statements too, like Luke 23, verse 46, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." This was a different man. And there was something very different going on this occasion. And the centurion is absorbing all of these things. But perhaps the thing which set him over the top to a statement of faith was when he was struck with what must have been a mixture of awe and fright at the way all creation around was convulsing at the crucifixion of the Son of God. In Matthew's version, in Matthew 27 and verses 50 through 54, says that for about half the time that Jesus was on the cross, for about 3 hours in the middle of the afternoon, from noon to 3, the sky was dark. And we can call that an eclipse, we call it whatever you want to, but the sky was dark. And that's a very ominous feeling. A feeling of dread and doom as all creation darkens to see the Creator himself hanging upon a cross. And Matthew tells us that there was a great earthquake, so powerful that the earth shook and that rocks were split. And I don't know if the centurion knew it at the time, before the news had a chance to circulate, but maybe there were cries going up around the temple district where the veil of the temple was ripped from top to bottom. Who knows? Maybe news of that traveled quickly as well. The centurion witnessed the convulsions in nature and realized that something very special was happening. And so he said at the end, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And if such a man, such a worldly, violent, jaded man, could stand at those events and come away with that understanding and to make that statement of faith, to confess the truth, this isn't a criminal. This is, as Luke's account puts it, an innocent man. This is the Son of God. Then certainly you and I can come away with the same conclusion after reading the account. We can understand that Jesus is someone special and that he demands our faith and our loyalty. Yes, the centurion makes a great statement of faith, but it goes even beyond that. And whether or not the centurion fully appreciated what it meant, what he was saying, that this was the Son of God, I'm not sure, but we can certainly appreciate it. And Mark records it so that we can see it also. This is God in the flesh, who willingly suffered this fate so that we might become saved. On the cross, Jesus took upon himself the penalty of sin that was due to us. That's how big, that's how great, that's how terrible sin is, because nothing else but the blood of the Son of God could or can provide forgiveness of sins. If you are not a follower of Jesus, you need to be. If you are a follower of Jesus, we have assembled together this morning, as we do every first day of the week, to commemorate that scene, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, the Son of God, the Christ, our Savior and our Master. The bread is his body, the fruit of the vine is his blood, the blood of a new covenant, so that we could become partakers of God. As we partake of this meal, let's think on these things.